coming to you from the Motor City.
This week on Detroit's Daily Docket, we have an interview with Dr. Martin Ishikawa. Hear about the journey he has taken from medical school, residency, fellowship at our office, and ultimately to the islands of Hawaii. Later in the episode, Dr. Sung and Dr. Reyes are discussing COVID-19. It is still on our minds after all. They will give an overview of the vaccines, vaccine myths, and the COVID-19 variants we are seeing emerge around the world. Stay tuned.
Welcome to a new episode of Detroit's Daily Docket. We're going to start something new where we are talking with different forensic pathologists throughout the country. And the reason why we decided to do that is because the practice of forensic pathology is very different from state to state, even local jurisdictions to local jurisdictions. So we wanted our listeners to get a feel for how practice is in different parts of the continental United States and also farther beyond our typical borders. Our first guest is Dr. Martin Ishikawa. He is a practicing forensic and surgical pathologist in Hawaii. He attended the John A. Burns School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii, and subsequently he did his training in anatomic and clinical pathology at the University of Michigan. He stayed on for 2 years after that, where he completed both his thoracic pathology and forensic pathology fellowships. He did his forensic pathology fellowship here at our office back in 2007. His current forensic practice is based around various coroner departments in the state of Hawaii, and he serves many of the smaller inter-island communities such as Kauai, Maui, the Big Island, and Molokai. So welcome, Dr. Ishikawa.
Thank you.
Before we get too much into some of our questions, I'd like to know what made you interested in forensic pathology.
Well, for me, the journey to pathology was a little unexpected. When I first went to medical school, I thought that I was actually going to return to my small town that I'm from in Hawaii and practice as a family medicine doctor. So after getting into medical school and getting introduced to pathology, I became interested and sought that out, and ended up making my way from Hawaii to the University of Michigan for residency. And coincidentally, the first rotation that I was assigned to while I was a resident was the autopsy service. And as a first-year resident, you actually get assigned holiday call. So as the other doctors know, July 1st is the start date for all residents. And I was assigned 4th of July as my holiday call. So 3 days in as being a resident, I got called in to do an autopsy on the 4th of July. And that was sort of my first experience to autopsies. And I have to say that I did really think it was very interesting and I enjoyed it. And I got, you know, a lot more experience with autopsies as residency went on. But hospital autopsies are very different than forensic autopsies. So I wanted to get that experience to see if it was a good fit for me. And so I did a elective rotation at the Wayne County office in my third year, I guess, of residency. And I did really enjoy that time there, and that sort of helped to solidify my decision to go into forensic pathology. There were a few important people along my path to making that decision while I was in residency. One of them, I know, Dr. Sung, you know, Dr. Amanda Fisher Hubbard.
For sure.
And she was a senior resident when I was a junior resident at Michigan. And her experience training at the Wayne County office was integral to helping me make my decision to enter that field.
Well, there's quite a difference between family medicine and pathology. What was it that steered you towards pathology?
Well, I think one of the things that I was drawn to in family medicine, being from a small town, was being connected to the community and feeling like you were making a contribution. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about forensic pathology was, you know, that of course you're doing the autopsies and also the day-to-day work, but at the end of the day, a lot of your interactions still keep you connected to the community, whether that's interacting with law enforcement or members of the justice system, or even providing counsel to next of kin. So I did think that, in contrast to a lot of other fields of pathology, there's sort of direct connection to community members that can be very rewarding.
How is your practice currently? Because clearly how you operate now is very foreign to myself. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So I kind of mentioned the introduction, about 50% of my time is currently spent being a forensic pathologist, I guess, and doing that type of work. The other 50%, I still do practice surgical pathology. So I think then that in and of itself is a little bit unique of a practice. I haven't encountered that too often. But in a place like Hawaii, where I guess the practice of pathology is still sort of generalized in a lot of areas, it helps to be able to wear a lot of different hats in terms of being a fit for a specific group. And what I mean by that is, my current practice is a private practice group, actually, that holds the contracts for multiple inter-island smaller coroner jurisdictions. And it's been that way traditionally for many decades. So I sort of fit into the general forensic pathology group, which is a smaller subset of pathologists within my larger private practice group.
If you could describe for us a typical week or a typical day in your life, what does that look like?
Yeah, so I do have a schedule where I am actively signing out both hospital-based pathology and doing forensic cases every week. But from the forensic side of things, that typical day is sort of variable. What I mean by that is that the volume of cases, you know, is dependent as they arise. And we have limited availability for forensic pathologists to serve these outer island jurisdictions in Hawaii. So we have to get out there promptly so that the decedent's bodies are not, you know, basically in hospitals too long, and they're able to service them in a timely fashion for the needs of mortuaries and next of kin. So I'm based on Oahu, which is helpful because that's the main island in Hawaii where most of the flights go out of. And so I will set my flight from Oahu as a round trip in the same day, and I'll fly in. Those trips typically take about 30 minutes to 50 minutes, depending on what island I'm going to. And so I'll touch down in an outer island, get my rental car, drive to the local community hospital where the body is that the coroner has asked that we examine. And I'll perform that autopsy in a local community hospital morgue. There is one exception to that setting. On the island of Maui, the county has had enough volume of forensic cases so that they have now built a dedicated police forensic facility, and that's where those cases are done. But in general, they're done in smaller community hospital morgues. And the police personnel that are involved in a typical case will meet us at the hospital if they're interested in that case, and then we'll proceed from there. And I'll typically do what we've accumulated in the day, so it may be a short day or maybe a full day of autopsy, and then I will fly back home at the end of the day. One of the things that I failed to mention that I should probably mention is that, you know, each of these jurisdictions are coroner jurisdictions. And in the state of Hawaii, by statute, the coroners are designated as each of the respective police departments. So they're not elected officials in the sense that they are in a lot of other parts of the country. It's just that by default, they're designated as the police departments.
Wow, it's quite a bit different. And if anyone ever complains about their commute, they have nothing to talk about.
You have a lot of miles. You probably have logged in a lot of airline miles.
Yeah, so that is the small perk. I have accumulated over 400,000 miles in the first 3 years.
Wow.
And now, just generally speaking about your caseload, you kind of briefly stated, what do you guys, at your offices, what do you typically see? You know, it's and since you've practiced here in Detroit before as a fellow, the differences between caseload and case type, could you describe that for us?
Yes, that's a great question. And it was sort of an eye-opener for me coming out to Hawaii. So I would say in terms of typical numbers, if I were to extrapolate the amount of cases that I'm doing now to 100% commitment to forensic pathology, it's about the same. You know, I think every year I've been here, I've done over 150 cases. And as I mentioned, you know, my commitment to forensic pathology on paper is only typically supposed to be about 50%. So the actual numbers, I wouldn't say differs too much from training, but the types of cases are very different. So that really showed me that the type of practice that a forensic pathologist sees and has is really dependent on your community milieu. For example, when I was at Detroit, I think I had one drowning case all year. And that is our most common accident, of course, in Hawaii. You know, I've sort of mentioned to my colleagues here in Hawaii that we found a lot of bodies in water in Detroit, but they just weren't drowning cases.
You don't get a lot of frozen bodies? We're getting a lot of frozen now.
Yeah. I mean, the reflex to a body in water in Detroit was to get an expert,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But that's not the reflex in Hawaii. So it's interesting because you are sort of in, I don't want to say a bubble, but in some ways your conception of forensic pathology is based on your community. I remember when I had the single drowning case in Detroit, it was mentioned to me that the autopsy findings of drowning are relatively nonspecific, and you know, it's all based on basically the death investigation and that type of additional information outside of the autopsy. And for better or for worse, I have to say that my opinion is somewhat changed about that. You know, after doing so many drowning cases in Hawaii, I think if you look for the right things in an autopsy, you can have a pretty strong opinion about whether someone drowned or not. And I think that's just gaining experience through the types of cases that you see. You know, in contrast, we don't get a lot of homicide in Hawaii. I remember as a fellow, I think about a third of my cases were homicide in the year I was there. You know, and when you finish the year in Detroit, you just, you've seen enough bullets, right, for a lot of people's entire practice, I think. But, you know, it pays a lot of dividends in the future, I have to say, because when you come to an area like Hawaii or maybe some other rural jurisdiction where there's not a lot of homicide, you're still going to get those cases, and it's going to be very important for you that you don't mishandle those cases or do them a disservice. You know, you really want to maintain the standards of forensic pathology when those cases come. So, you know, that's what happens in Hawaii. Just for, you know, to kind of put a concrete number for my homicides, you know, I'm probably doing 10 or less a year, right? So a lot less.
Very
and
different. Yeah.
Even the types of homicide is different. You know, Hawaii doesn't seem to be a state that has a lot of gun-related deaths. But I remember as one of the previous attendings at Wayne County used to say, Dr. Francisco Diaz, that if people want to find a way to harm each other, they're going to do it. And Dr. Diaz had practiced previously in a jurisdiction where there really weren't guns, but had a lot of experience with stabbing types of cases. And I have to say that that's probably, you know, the type of thing that I see more in Hawaii. So I see a lot more blunt force, and I see a lot more sharp force. Mm-hmm. So I would say there's a major difference there in terms of homicide. The other major difference that stands out in my mind, that's a huge difference from training, is sort of the types of drug-related deaths that we see in different parts of the country. I'm going to use the term mainland. But on the mainland, and particularly, you know, of course, in the Midwest, the opioid epidemic is a major problem. And when I was in Detroit, opioid-related deaths were a major part of our caseload. And in Hawaii, that's just not the case. So the drug of choice in Hawaii is methamphetamine. Mm. You know, I would say that accounts for 80 to 90% of our drug-related deaths, methamphetamine. So I rarely see the opioid-related overdoses nowadays. Occasionally, I will get them. And anecdotally, it's interesting. Most of those cases are folks who are not from Hawaii, it seems, and are just sort of passing through.
Yeah, I was wondering, due to the resource availability of various things, if it was methamphetamines that were manufactured on the islands themselves.
Yeah, you know, I am involved with providing our drug death data to the agencies out here, one of the monitoring agencies, which has some information as to the origin of methamphetamine, since they have some resources with federal investigation. And I've been told, again, anecdotally, is that the vast majority of methamphetamine that comes in through Hawaii is actually from south of the border in Mexico.
So you brought up some definite differences in regions. Now, from where you are practicing right now, is there something that you wished you knew before you started?
Well, I think I was sort of getting a small idea about this in training when I was going to testify as a fellow. But I think it can be very helpful to say, I don't know, when you really don't know. I do think that as forensic pathologists, we get very comfortable and in the role of providing answers to people. You know, we're often being asked questions about what we think about things, what we saw. And so the knee-jerk response can be sometimes to provide the answer. And that can get you into a little bit of trouble, particularly in court when you testify. Mm-hmm. So I think that if you really don't know, you just say, I don't know. And I do think that can actually help you when you testify, because I think it can help to build rapport with the jury. You know, juries are very smart, and they, you know if someone's generally trying their best to give an honest answer. So when you say something like, I don't know, I think they tend to pay attention more when you give a definitive answer.
Is there anything as far as a fellowship training program that we could have done better?
I don't think so, Dr. Song. I'm going to say that Wayne County is the best training program
out
there.
Nice. Very good plug. Shameless plug.
That was a test. Yeah. You know, years later. no, I don't think so. I'm not sure how the fellowship is oriented nowadays, but when I was there, I think about 30% of our time was actually spent for Washtenaw County and Ann Arbor. Yeah.
Still the same.
So it's about 70% Detroit, 30% Ann Arbor.
It's about every other month, so a little bit more 50-50 now.
It's closer to 50, but not quite 50-50.
50-50.
Yeah, not quite.
Oh, you guys must have three fellows.
Oh, we wish.
We wish.
I actually think there's a lot of value to the organization of the fellowship that way. And I know when I had started, that format was relatively new, since it was a program that had sort of just come under the wing of the University of Michigan. And so there were sort of varying opinions as to the value of having the rotation organized that way. But I think the idea was that you can, you know, sort of have, as a trainee, the experience of working in a busy inner city office,
yeah, exactly.
Where there's a high homicide rate. And then, of course, having that juxtaposed mm-hmm. with, you know, maybe a more typical rural, not rural, but, you know, less busy jurisdiction like Ann Arbor. And maybe at the time I didn't see the direct value in that, but I can say that certainly in practice that has helped me a lot, because, you know, my typical practice, if it was going to parallel one of those, is probably closer to Washtenaw. And at least having that experience, I think, helped me to adjust a bit more.
And now that you are in practice for a couple of years now, can you think of maybe your biggest challenge as of yet, since starting, since I'm just starting off my career as well? What was your biggest challenge now that you're a forensic pathologist?
The biggest challenge on a day-to-day for me now, I have to say, is adjusting to the resources available to me in a smaller corner jurisdiction. Because we don't have our own office, I am sort of at the whim of the resources that the coroner has put into the case prior to autopsy. And what I mean by that is, you know, I had mentioned by state statute that the coroners are all the police departments. Mm-hmm. And they are required by law to provide some sort of investigation into a suspected non-natural death. And that, you know, is something that when you're in a independent medical examiner office, you have more control over in terms of directing death investigation and the appropriate ancillary investigation that should have been done prior to a case. So, of course, I can have an opinion about what should be done. And it is a two-way road where, you know, I can provide some sort of guidance and recommendations as to what I would like for a case. But at the end of the day, if the police departments have done what they think is sufficient, I'm sort of left with that.
Mm.
So that can be somewhat frustrating in certain types of cases where there is a disconnect, I think, between maybe a formally trained forensic pathologist and the degree of investigation that is deemed appropriate by someone through the lens of a police officer. So I'm being a little bit vague. But maybe one of the specific examples I can say in Hawaii that I do think lags probably the rest of the nation is infant death investigation. So we know that as forensic pathologists that a lot of certain specific things mm-hmm. about the death investigation and scene investigation for infant-related deaths is very important in order to get to an accurate cause of death. And unfortunately, a lot of those things are lacking in some of the reports that I will get, particularly in smaller jurisdictions, which I can't really typically fault, because for maybe a jurisdiction like Molokai, Molokai is a fascinating place because it's so small, right? There's actually only one assigned detective for the whole island. There's no street light on Molokai. There are only a few stop signs. So for me to expect that one detective to know what type of death investigation mm-hmm. I am expecting as a forensic pathologist for every single type of case, including infant deaths, is probably a little unreasonable. But at the end of the day, I'm still left with those cases and how I'm going to sign them out. So that can be a little bit frustrating sometimes. I do try to do my role as gently educating
mm-hmm. yes.
as much as I can. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm still working with these same officers day in and day out. So we try to have a very cordial professional relationship, which I think we do.
You were talking about resources. Just for clarification, when you travel to do the autopsies, is it just you eviscerating, dissecting, doing talks, doing photography? Or does someone come with you, an autopsy attendant or a deaner or a tech?
Well, that is a great question. Every county is a little different. For the most part, what's kind of an interesting foundation that's built into the practice is that the private practice group that I work for, their name is Clinical Labs of Hawaii, and they are actually the private pathology group that has serviced all of these community hospitals for many years. So because they've done that, they actually hold the hospital contracts as well. They have that staff in place in terms of at least someone there. Some laboratory-based person is there who is somewhat familiar with autopsy. Again, because, you know, we have limited resources. These are not formally trained deaners, as you had kind of alluded to. So the types of people that will be assisting me with cases are generally histology staff or histotechs, people that they've sort of tapped that they should be able to help me because they have some exposure to tissue. But their experience and how much they can do for me really varies between different areas. So actually in Hilo, which is one of the larger cities on the Big Island, where we do have a significant amount of volume, they've actually been able to dedicate two people who the vast majority of the time are assisting with autopsies. And that's just because of the volume of that area and the needs that are specific to that area. And those folks there, you know, as you can imagine, even though they don't have a formal title of a deaner, their familiarity with autopsy and the things I would like to do with the case is pretty good. And then in smaller areas, you know, you'll have to do a lot more. But I would say that I probably, in each individual case I do, 80% of the evisceration. I draw the vast majority of my own tocks, and that has helped me, I think, learn a few new tricks in my practice. You don't really understand the luxury of having formally trained techs until you don't have them.
Now, if you were speaking with somebody who was inquiring about going to Hawaii for practice, is there any advice you'd give to them?
You know, there's probably two points on that. I think people who are sort of generally incident forensic pathology, if they are really interested in it, they should try to get some type of exposure to seeing what the day-to-day sort of rigors are prior to committing completely. Being able to, I think, that have the privilege of doing a forensic pathology fellowship is really at the very end, right? I mean, you've already gone through 4 years of medical mm-hmm. school and 3 or 4 years of residency. And then at the very end, you kind of have to make this life-altering decision. So I think the sooner that you can gain some exposure, if someone's interested and maybe there's some type of program available in their community where they can either shadow a forensic pathologist or get some sort of exposure to what they do early on, I think that's good. And I've been able to have a few pre-medical students get some exposure to that since I've been in practice here in Hawaii, and I think it's helped to clarify a lot of what we really do for them. And I think that's really important before making the commitment to forensic pathology, because I think there are certain things about the field that are very hard and common. And if you're not able to get a handle on that early on, I think that it's tough to stick in the field. And then specific to Hawaii, sort of that other point, I think if coming to Hawaii is a practice goal for you and you have the experience of being in a typical medical examiner office, I think it's to have an open mind that you're entering a community that doesn't have probably as much exposure to formally trained forensic pathologists as a lot of other areas. And so with that comes some misinformation. And you do have to work in a role as kind of an educator of those folks that you're interacting with. So I'll give you an example. When I first came to Hawaii, one of our smaller jurisdictions had been served in the past for many years by a general pathologist. And general pathologists are very comfortable with doing directed autopsies, right? Which is what your training is in the hospital. What I mean by that is that you would do an autopsy to answer a particular clinical question. So say, for instance, there's a kidney tumor mm-hmm. in someone who died in the hospital and they wanted to know more about that, you would do the autopsy and direct your examination toward the kidney. But as forensic pathologists, we're trained to either do an external exam or to do a full autopsy, with very few exceptions to that. So that was something that I had to address, and seems like something that I wouldn't even think about, you know, but sort of explaining to a jurisdiction why we're not going to do a full autopsy in a case mm-hmm. Can actually take a lot of time. What's interesting is in Hawaii, the coroner will absorb cases where there's no primary care available to sign a death certificate. Mm-hmm. So come Monday, we've always absorbed, you know, these 80, 90-year-old wow. natural deaths who have all the medical reasons to die. Mm-hmm. But the coroner, you know, was contacted and found the body in an area where the primary care physician is not available. In most medical examiner offices, those cases wouldn't come in. They would be rejected. Mm-hmm. But in Hawaii, a lot of these smaller jurisdictions sort of serve that community service function where they take in these cases, and I'm not going to do autopsies on them.
In talking with other pathologists, and not specifically in your region, but in other countries, are there any pervasive misconceptions that they have about working in the paradise of Hawaii?
What's interesting about folks who have at least physicians that I know, and this applies to both forensic pathology and physicians I know outside of forensic pathology. People come to Hawaii and think that, oh, you know, there won't be a ton of work and it'll be paradise and I'll be at the beach, you know, after half an hour at work and everyone's drinking out of coconuts on their lunch break. And I would say that, you know, that's not true, right? And every area of the country has their problems, mm-hmm. right? Because it's where people live. And everywhere there's people, there's problems. So, you know, we still have our homicide cases, right? We still have cases that are, you know, really stunning in terms of the type of injury that we see. And when those cases happen, there's an expectation that you're going to do them service. So, mm-hmm. I don't think the standards, I guess, change much where you go. It's just sort of how you approach it. That's probably one of the things in Hawaii that I think is important, that we still get those kinds of cases, albeit not as common. But the expectation of what you're going to do with them when they happen is still the same.
Now, on the lighter side of things, if you had your wish, what tool would you want to help you perform your job?
Well, I think the tool that I would pick is kind of a boring answer, but it's a scalpel, right? I mean, I think the scalpel, you can just do so much with.
But you can't cut a skull with it. You can't cut a skull with a scalpel.
That's true. That's true. But, you know, it's hard to open a chest wall with a saw.
That's true.
Getting through the skin. So I think you can do a lot with a scalpel, and I have done a lot. I think the utility in terms of the different types of actions you can do with it is probably what I'd pick.
Okay.
Desert island, one tool.
Yes. Scalpel. Okay.
Fair enough. Now, even more out there, if you could have a superpower, what would you want to have?
Well, it would have to be X-ray vision, Dr. Sun.
Ah, yeah.
I thought you didn't say flying.
No, because, you know, I'm still going to have to work at the end of the day, right? I'm still going to have to do my forensic pathology stuff so I can pick this power and it can help me in my everyday work.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, oh my goodness, in Detroit as a fellow,
oh, yes.
where you're dealing with so many multiple
yes.
gunshot wound cases, I mean, think about the amount of time you would save not having to re-x-ray.
Well, Dr. Ishikawa, I had a great time talking with you today. I wish you the best of luck, and I'll ship some snow to you.
Send us some coconuts. We'll send you snow.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. For this half of the episode, we'll be discussing the rollouts of the COVID-19 vaccines, and we'll briefly touch on the new emerging SARS-CoV-2 variants. Joining me here is Dr. Reyes. Dr. Reyes, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Before we get into this segment, I want to put a little asterisk or a proviso on our discussion. Because the word or label of COVID-19 is so prevalent, as we are talking, we might accidentally interchange the virus, SARS-CoV-2, for the disease, COVID-19. And as long as we can all agree that we're all talking about the same entity, we'll be fine. Okay, now that that's out of the way, let's get on with the discussion. How about let's start with the COVID-19 vaccinations? Dr. Reyes, can you please explain how these vaccines are different from previous ones?
Sure. First, let me explain how vaccines work. The immune system works by eliminating any foreign virus or bacteria from your body. Vaccines work by teaching the immune system how to react to a viral or bacterial threat. There are four main types of vaccines: live attenuated vaccines, inactivated vaccines, toxoid vaccines, and subunit vaccines. Live attenuated vaccines contain weakened infectious agents, like the measles or chickenpox vaccines. Inactivated vaccines contain dead infectious agents, like the flu or polio vaccines. Toxoid vaccines use inactivated toxin, like the tetanus vaccine. Subunit vaccines contain a part of the virus or bacteria, like the HPV vaccine. The newest COVID vaccines produced by Moderna and Pfizer are mRNA or messenger RNA vaccines.
Now, just briefly, you mentioned the HPV vaccine. For those that don't know, this vaccine is against the human papillomavirus, or HPV. And HPV infections can lead to certain cancers, such as those found in the cervix, the vulva, and the vagina. Now, moving back to COVID-19, what are mRNA vaccines?
So mRNA vaccines are messenger RNA vaccines. So these vaccines contain genetic material which teaches the body how to make a viral protein. This protein can trigger an immune response and lead to acquired immunity against the virus. So to produce a protein, the cell makes a single-stranded copy of the DNA, which is the genetic material inside the nucleus of the cell. This single-stranded copy of the DNA is called mRNA. Each mRNA holds information on how to make one type of protein. The cell reads the messenger RNA and makes a protein. Researchers started with the genetic sequence of the virus and identified the part which produces a viral protein, and that part is called the spike protein. Rather than synthesizing this viral protein, researchers took a faster route by making the messenger RNA that codes for that protein. Once this mRNA is administered, the body starts manufacturing the viral spike protein, which gets recognized by the immune system. This will not result in sickness, but will give immunity. However, the drawback of these mRNA vaccines is that mRNA is very sensitive and can be degraded quickly if not kept at cold temperatures.
And because both the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines utilize the mRNA, they both have to be refrigerated properly.
Yes.
And how do the other COVID vaccines work?
So COVID vaccines from AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, which were authorized recently, utilize adenovirus, which is a virus that causes common cold. This delivers DNA material coding for the viral protein, which is more stable and does not require being stored in cold temperatures. However, over time, the body will mount an immune reaction to this virus, which means that the future doses using this carrier virus will become eventually less effective.
Now, when they're using the adenovirus, it's not as if they're giving you the common cold. They're using components of that virus. They've made it safe so they're not infecting you with that, per se. Now, there are people who do question the safety of vaccines. In fact, I've had people who ask me myself, you know, is the vaccine safe? And they talk about delaying it or opting out of it completely. I know some of these fears of vaccines have been around for decades. If you recall, back in roughly 1997 or 1998, there was a research group headed by Dr. Wakefield who published an article in The Lancet trying to tie autism with vaccinations. The scientific community has clearly disproven the paper written by Dr. Wakefield, and some of the authors of that original paper have retracted their contributions, and in fact, Dr. Wakefield himself has had his license stripped. And even though that happened nearly 25 years ago, still some of those fears exist. And in regards to the COVID-19 vaccinations, there are those fears. And some of those fears come from the fact that people feel that they were developed and approved in record time. I definitely can understand that too, but it is not that the steps involved in the approval process were skipped. It's just the timeline has been accelerated. The high motivation for producing this vaccine, coupled with the scientific advancements, really made it possible. Now, even though the timeline was shortened, the vaccines were not rolled out until they were proven safe by clinical trials, which had thousands of individuals involved.
Dr. Sung, can you please walk us through the process of making a vaccine?
There are many steps involved in the process. I'm not going to go over all of those steps in detail, but on the very basic level, the first step is the creation of the vaccine in the laboratory. As you mentioned, the mRNA technology used in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines and the adenovirus technologies used for the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson. So it starts in the lab. Then it moves to the clinical trials, the phase trials, as people have heard of. Phase 1 evaluates the safety and side effects and determines the dosage of the vaccine or medication and or drug. This is done on a small group of people who are free from illness. It's used to see if there are any adverse reactions. Phase 2 tests the effectiveness of the vaccines on a larger scale. Here, hundreds are tested, and it includes people with varying health and demographic groups. Phase 3 confirms the safety and effectiveness of the drug or vaccine on the scale of thousands of people. After phase 3, the drug can be authorized by the FDA and is released.
What are the side effects of the vaccine, and did you have any symptoms after receiving your dose of vaccine?
Generally, the side effects of the vaccine can include pain at the injection site, fatigue, headache, fevers and chills. The side effects can vary from person to person, and this also gives some people some anxiety. A person might hear that someone they knew developed these fevers and chills, and that might make them not want to take the vaccine. Although these symptoms can happen, they are often easily treated with over-the-counter acetaminophen, for example, and it really indicates the body's immune response to the vaccine. I personally only noticed injection site tenderness after receiving both doses of the Pfizer vaccine. How about you?
Well, I only felt arm soreness after the first dose. However, a day after the second dose, I developed fatigue, headaches, and chills. These symptoms were mild and were gone by the following day. What are the common myths about the COVID-19 vaccinations?
Before we talk about the vaccine-related myths, I think one of the biggest myths is claiming that COVID-19 is not real. It definitely is real. There are many other myths about the efficacy of wearing masks. However, one of the stranger vaccine myths that I've heard is that the COVID vaccine contains microchips that will help use to spy on people. Both Dr. Reyes and I have received the vaccine, and we can assure you that there are no microchips in our blood.
Can someone infect others after receiving the vaccine?
Vaccinated people can still get infected with the virus and spread it to other people. Although the vaccine protects a person from being sick, it doesn't prevent the infection. Thus, a person who already received the vaccine can be asymptomatic and spread the infection to others. That's why wearing masks and following social distancing measures is still required.
So when are we going back to normal?
That's really hard to say. And what is considered quote-unquote normal really has changed. But one important threshold to achieve is herd immunity. This will happen when the majority of the population is vaccinated and the prevalence of the virus is too low to pose a major risk. I can't give you a number for that percentage, and even the experts are debating that. Another looming concern are the new variants of the virus, which are far more transmissible and could make the existing vaccines less effective.
Let's talk more about these variants. What is a coronavirus variant?
All viruses, including SARS-CoV-2, constantly mutate into new versions as they replicate. Most of the genetic changes are insignificant, but over time they can lead to alterations in the virus surface proteins. The first variant of the virus is known as B.1.1.7. It was first detected in the UK around September and was reported in the US by the end of December. Another variant called B.1.351 has emerged in South Africa in early October of 2020, and it was also reported in the US by the end of January. In Brazil, a variant called P.1 emerged and was first detected in the US at the end of January. This shows how fast these variants can spread.
Why are these variants spreading faster?
Research has shown that a number of these variants have mutated spike proteins. The spike protein is the part of the virus that attaches to a receptor on a human cell, causing the infection. When spike proteins are altered by a mutation, this can affect how they can bind to the receptor. The new variants have a greater ability to bind to human cells due to the shape of their spike proteins, which give them more ability to infect.
This is concerning, but the good news is that the count of daily new infections have declined sharply, as well as the number of new deaths related to the virus, which proves that the vaccine is changing the course of this pandemic. Dr. Song, do you have anything to add before we end this part?
I'm optimistic about the future as long as we don't let our guards down. I know that people are becoming fatigued and they want to go out, they want to go to restaurants, they want to go shopping, but we all have to hold fast. We need to maintain our social distancing and we need to wear appropriate face coverings. We'll get through this, but we all have to play our parts. Stay safe, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on Detroit's Daily Docket. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Detroit's Daily Docket. Our theme song is Living by Read the Sun, and our podcast cover art is by Hollow Wicked Prince. Thank you for listening.